Hi, and welcome to another thoughtful episode of The Cyber Show. Today we're in the chair with Dr. Kate Brown, and we're talking about technology and human relations. Today, Andy and Kate talk about our ownership of technology and what it means for our sense of responsibility and social awareness.
What does it mean when people seem desperate for help, but they're unwilling to pay? What does that say about their relation to technology?
I wonder whether it says the technology that I use is someone else's problem, because people feel potentially disempowered by technology. They aren't actually able to take much ownership of it, and therefore aren't potentially willing to educate themselves about how they could use technology in a safer, more private, more ethical way.
I agree with you. I think people don't feel a genuine sense of ownership with their technology.
And I wonder whether that sense of not ownership leads to the kind of dissociated behaviour that we can see online. So whereas Freud, when he was observing the group irrationality involved in the rise of Nazism, actually there is something about technology that people say and do things to each other that in the beginning they can't imagine doing or saying in person.
It has a dehumanising effect, yeah. And a diffusion of responsibility,
yeah.
And a dislocation of responsibility,
yeah.
And ownership.
Yeah.
Those are the three kind of key, yeah, things there, I think. And so you're saying that those three effects people are applying to themselves as users of technology?
Not necessarily apply to themselves, but apply to the technology that they use. It's almost as if there is something in them that says the technology that I use doesn't really matter, and it doesn't really matter how I treat people online, whether I send an offensive tweet or things like that, that it doesn't matter, that my use of technology doesn't matter.
Okay, but I want to take it further. It's not that my use of technology doesn't matter and other people don't matter, but then they're saying I don't matter. I don't matter as a user, because what we're seeing is a refusal to exercise basic self-care.
Yeah.
If people think that they are their technology and they devalue that technology because it's foisted upon them, because the reality of it is this illusion that we have about choice, that you choose to go out and buy an iPhone. Well, it seems like that on the face of it, but what we hear again and again is that people don't feel that they have that choice.
Yeah.
They talk about smartphones as being a necessity and not being able to function in life without it. And that is a horrendous imposition. So how can you relate positively to a device that you're forced to carry around?
And that you feel that you've got no control over.
Right. It's almost like you're forced to wear a star or carry an identity card or something. You can't really have a very positive relationship to that enforced thing, can you? So I think, yeah, that definitely is part of the explanation for that. What about in therapy? You know, the saying that if you don't pay, you don't get better. Let me tell you how I understand that. I mean, this is from an Adam Phillips talk. He talks about money and says, well, it's just about the commitment to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why it can be very tricky in private therapy if someone else other than the patient is paying for therapy, because there might be all sorts of motives and kind of unspoken subclauses about that. Whereas a patient who comes and has negotiated a manageable fee to them actually is taking some responsibility and is also dealing with a certain amount of reality. And so hopefully it's a way of kind of valuing the process, and in valuing the process also taking some responsibility and ownership.
This is going to be quite an issue, and I think we'll come back to that a little bit later, that when people want the government to pay for something.
But also I was thinking when you were talking earlier is that I am reminded of situations where a person's work might pay for their training, and that having benefits and disadvantages. It might have disadvantage if someone has had bad experience of mandatory training that is poorly delivered, that didn't really meet the person's needs who was attending the training. Also, people might be less committed if they aren't personally invested in doing the training.
I think if the government pay for people's cybersecurity training, then we've got a double problem. That they're getting somebody else's training them about the technology that they're not attached to or invested in the first place. So, I mean, we've kind of covered that a little bit. The sense of imposition and non-ownership. Can people take responsibility for technology that they feel is forced upon them? People don't really feel they have much of a choice with technology.
Yeah.
But they should. It should be like any other product in the world, like food or choice of to travel by bus or train or car.
We are both familiar with my story of when I worked in a statutory service, a perfectly serviceable feature phone that worked and was fine, allowed me to do what I needed to do, being taken away from me. And I was told, you have to have a smartphone, Kate. And that particular smartphone ended up locked in a metal filing cabinet.
That was a very aggressive move, I thought. They didn't consult you.
No.
They just turned up one day and said, we're taking away these phones that we've issued. I mean, they're within their every right to, as an employer, legally, and not morally. But to take away your familiar communication tool. So now you're having these smartphones, and the reason being that they're filled with tracking software and spyware and things. And your response was to program it with a quote password that you immediately forgot and then locked it in the bottom of a metal filing cabinet to which you lost the key.
Yes, it was locked in a filing cabinet.
A series of unfortunate events befell that phone, let's say.
It was tragic.
Yeah, and I think your story is extremely commonplace. I think many people's relation to technology provided by their employers is sabotage.
Because also the intrusion.
This approach to technology in which it's forced upon people in a non-ownership capacity. I've put here that it heralds the neo-communism in the World Economic Forum's phrasing of you'll own nothing and be happy.
It makes me think of ownership in terms of not only material goods, and I think that in the digital world, it complicates things so much, the fact that I guess many people kind of store documents on the cloud, and there is this question of ownership.
People don't own records or books anymore.
Yeah.
They have a file on a Kindle or they stream it from Spotify.
But also, it makes me think of ownership in terms of taking responsibility. And what is meant by that is that I can acknowledge that, I can think about that, I could take responsibility for that, and I can be a little bit reflective and honest. But I don't think that people are any of those things with regards to their technology.
No.
They aren't reflective about how their use of technology might be impacting themselves, other people, their intimate relationship, their personal dignity, democracy, their privacy.
Okay, so that's very interesting. People don't own their technology in a psychological sense. Yeah. They don't take ownership of it. What is it then? Is it an interloper, an alien, a master, some kind of intruder in their world? What is it?
I think it can be all those things, but I'm intrigued by the idea of technology or digital technology as a master. And I went to an acquaintance home, and this particular acquaintance mentioned a book, and their Alexa came on and said, would you like to add this book to your basket?
Did you even know that there was an Alexa on in the room at the time?
I did not know that.
See, I think that's a transgression.
Yeah, I didn't know that the Alexa was on. I found it intrusive, but also I felt that it had almost like the voice of a master. Would you like to? So it was couched in, would you like to? But the blatant capitalist greed of kind of add this to your basket.
They're having it interjecting at that point.
Yes.
I mean, there's so much wrong with that.
Yeah.
But my principal thing is the consent. I would tell somebody often, and even a close friend, I'm not at all happy You've invited me into this space with a network-enabled surveillance device running, and you haven't told me. But thankfully, I don't know anybody now who has Alexas. They've all gone in the bin.
I don't know anyone who's got an Alexa, no.
No, I mean, they were some kind of passing fad. So the way I interpret that World Economic Forum thing is you'll own nothing and not give a shit. And not giving a shit about anything is not the same as happiness. It's simply an absence of attachment, and not even in the good Buddhist sense of not being attached to the things that will give you pain. Does any of that make sense to you?
Well, I wonder whether it's like the difference between owning and renting a house. So when you own a house, you have certain responsibilities for that house. If the boiler breaks, then I'm going to have to fix the boiler. There's going to be certain maintenance that I'm going to have to do on the house. But when someone is renting, then there is the illusion of, I don't have any responsibility.
I don't have any responsibility. And we call this convenience. That's what the word convenience has come to mean.
Yeah, and sometimes rental arrangements are convenient and helpful and useful and right for people.
Living a rented life, living in hotel rooms, hiring cars, having takeaway food, seems a very superficial life. It's something that maybe is embraced by a certain generation. Seems something very attractive when you're in your 20s. That does not seem like the kind of life that's fit for maturing people and people who want to start families and so on. So to me, that mentality, the way that it is in tech, you only have cloud services. You don't own your own computer anymore. And that, I would call it almost infantile lack of responsibility. You know, mum's going to clean up your room kind of thinking. That doesn't seem like something that can sustain through an adult's life.
I want to make links between that sense of irresponsibility and mum's going to clean up your room with actually the current state of the housing market, where ownership is beyond far too many's people's grasp. And actually, if home ownership is beyond young people's grasp, why shouldn't they get the takeaway and rent and go for convenience? And actually, it might be people who are hoping to buy do end up living back under the roof of their parent in their mid-30s, where mum might still come in and clean your bedroom, although you would kind of hope not with someone in their mid-30s, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just quite a striking analogy. It's a good one. Living with your parents in your mid, late 30s or 40s or whatever, it is in the technological realm, like, you know, running Microsoft, you know, because you're not able to, you know, install an operating system on it. Do any of the kind of things that when I was at school doing digital literacy in the 80s were considered basic things, like tying your shoelaces. Suddenly that became, oh, that's a bit complicated, isn't it? And of course it's not. It's simple, like home economics, if you like.
But people not only might live in an environment where the whole financial setup is designed to do things like make it a lot harder for young people to own a house. There's a lot of debt. Buying things on credit isn't true ownership, isn't true taking responsibility. Buying something on credit isn't the same.
When you say set up, you're saying it's not a blind set of economic circumstances, but the system is designed to exclude and keep those people down.
Possibly, probably.
Probably, and what I'm thinking is that, you know, by analogy, the tech ecosystem is very much designed to inhibit people from technological autonomy.
Yeah, but where I was also going is that I think a lot of people go from a sense of feeling powerless in the face of not only the technology that they're using and also the state of the economic and housing market, but they also go to jobs where they are actively disempowered with regards to the technology that they use as well.
Let's stick with this theme of external disempowerment, but also self-disempowerment or lack of self-care, lack of personal responsibility. I don't want to end up sounding like Jordan Peterson here, so maybe I'm using strong words, but I mean, we hear this all the time, and I don't know how true it is, that people don't care about privacy, and that people will even denounce it themselves as if they're ashamed in the face of surveillance capitalism. And they say things like, well, I've got nothing important. I'm nothing special. And I think that seems to indicate a lack of dignity or self-value.
I think it does too, but I think that there is a defensiveness about that. And what the defensiveness is that they're not able to imagine things that they might want to keep private. And so in society, it's become ubiquitous to kind of say, oh, well, I'm going to go on a date with that stranger or meeting that person. Of course, I Googled them, you know, before I met them. But actually what is missed out in that, well, of course I Googled them, is two things. One is the joy of discovering someone for them rather than what is publicly available out there for them, about them. And secondly, it assumes that that person had a little bit of control over what was online about them. And I think not enough people have either self-control to actually think, no, I'm not going to put that ranty tweet out there, but also kind of they're not able to control what someone else might put out about them. And quite frankly, that they're, I think that it takes away some of the magic of discovering, you know, what someone...
Absolutely, okay. I mean, so you talked a bit about public persona there.
Yeah.
And you said, when somebody's going to meet somebody, would they Google them? Obviously, you know this about me, but yeah. Whenever I'm about to meet somebody really interesting, I often stop and do not research them. I'll do the minimum necessary, because for the exact... that exact reason. I actually like to go into the encounter naive and through body language, through non-verbal communication, experience that discovering of them.
Yeah.
And I think when two people meet and they've already done massive amounts of recon on each other, like as in a job interview or something, that's stilted, unpleasant. It's a synthetic conversation. Yeah. And very little of value is exchanged or discovered. So I do completely get that. And also there's this issue of the fact that people very, very closely manage what they put online now. So you're not going to find anything that the other person didn't want you to discover. And if they're a sex predator, well, you're going to discover every single part of their trap, right? So the value of that recon using Google or whatever is pretty rubbish, to be honest. But I'm not sure that that's quite the question. So let me go back over it because I think we're missing something. People are withholding secrecy. Well, it's called a chilling effect, right? When the things that people divulge or don't divulge about themselves are massively influenced by their expectations of the environment. And I think it goes in two different directions. I mean, one is that some people faced with ubiquitous mass surveillance become performers. They act up to it. They start to become exhibitionists in a hope to construct an acceptable public persona, right? I think some of that's going on. And so when you say, well, don't you have any secrets? Don't you have any dignity or desire for privacy? They say, no, of course I don't. I'm an open book, as if that were a virtue.
Mm.
And they're missing the virtue of the undiscovered. They're missing the virtue of the how somebody might want to be a little bit of an enigma, got a bit of mystery to me, you know.
I wonder whether actually what's going on is conflict avoidance. So when people repeatedly have their privacy intruded upon and they understand that the individual or group or state or people doing that invasion aren't going to be able to hear, go away, stop intruding, it becomes something that's avoided.
So they're avoiding asserting their rights to privacy.
Yeah.
A demand for privacy,
yeah.
The demand for their rights to privacy.
Yeah.
It's not something that people feel comfortable publicly voicing.
Yeah.
But what do you think they imagine is going to happen? You know, that the Stasi are going to kick their door in and install microphones in their front room, or that they're going to incur the ire of their peers. I mean, I think that's probably more that's going on, is because there is then a competition amongst a group of people who are all essentially conformist to out-normal each other.
Mm.
Oh, well, I've got even less to hide than you. Mm. You know, I'm the perfect model citizen. Look at me.
Mm.
And there's almost a competitive self-deprecation going on there. They're worried that those peers are going to say, well, you must be a right bloody weirdo if you've got some kind of dignified thing that you'd like to keep private, because we're all open books here.
I think privacy exists in a relational context. So actually what I sometimes say in the privacy of the consulting room is you will feel how you will feel, but feelings are not fact, and feelings are also not behaviours. So you might want to say something like, I feel like killing my bloody mother-in-law or something like that, but that's not the same as I am going to do that. And there will be times where people feel able to confide that feeling in someone else. Sometimes people won't even be able to admit that feeling.
But this is a terrible tragedy, isn't it? And this is why they're ending up in the consulting room.
Yeah.
Because in an age of extraordinary scrutiny,
yeah,
and ridiculous concepts like hate speech,
yeah,
in which people are grotesquely judged for their speech acts as if they had actually performed those acts.
Yeah.
That's an extremely chilling society to live in.
I agree.
And I think that people have to tolerate that kind of society are destined for some kind of mental breakdown at some point.
We Live in Public. You know, that documentary.
Josh Harris one.
Yeah.
But all of those people in Josh Harris's documentary, it wasn't his documentary, it was on him, I've forgotten the director, but they all went mad.
Mm.
I mean, really, I mean, they all became extraordinary exhibitionists. They ended up firing guns in some kind of basement concentration camp.
Mm.
And the whole thing had to be broken up by the police before it kind of turned into some kind of Jonestown, you know.
But I think that it is the error of the authoritarian personality that believes that taking away people's privacy as a way of dominating and taking people's power is any kind of way of creating a healthy society or group. It makes me think of a building that I worked in that had lots of individual rooms where groups of about 2, 3, 4 people could work in, build collegial relationships, but there was always a sense of this building allows for private conversation.
Yeah, people had offices. That's how it used to be in the universities.
And exactly.
And once you'd moved everyone into open plan offices, then productivity went through the floor because nobody could concentrate anymore, but also nobody felt a sense of necessary isolation and privacy.
And morale dropped because actually part of the task of what needed to happen in my line of work was that people needed the privacy to actually be able to reflect with one another and communicate intimately and privately along the lines of, actually, this is how I'm feeling about a certain situation. And that was absolutely imperative to us being able to do our job.
Hmm. Authoritarians who create those kinds of conditions have no interest, in my opinion, about productivity or people being able to do their jobs. It's not about that. They're on some other kind of pathological level. I was thinking then of Chun when he had gone back to do his military service in Taiwan and came back very traumatised and had said, well, you know, it was more than just barracks. They basically we were forced to be in one huge warehouse in the open, like a panopticon, observed from above all of the time. And that whole project of dehumanisation was designed to break them down.
Yeah.
And military psychology has gone on leaps and bounds since hopefully that mentality exists. But do you want a box of broken soldiers? There's something else going on there that's not to do with productivity or creating the right conditions. It's just about almost sadism.
Yeah.
There's something really broken about that system.
And it was really interesting that the people who advocated for this open plan office hot desking arrangement were also the most insecure. And their rationale was, oh, well, we don't want to make cliques.
This is a really interesting point because it comes from a combination of an authoritarian personality and an insecure personality.
Yeah.
You put those two things together and you create that tyranny of surveillance because those people quite pathologically think that everyone else is plotting against them.
Yeah, there is that paranoia of, does secrecy mean something that I have to be concerned about?
Whereas in a healthy relationship of any kind, you grant the other person freedom and secrecy as an act of trust.
Yeah.
But partly because you just simply can't process it. You can't live their life for them. You can't possibly know everything about, I mean, even just for one person, never mind an entire company or an entire population, it's patently ridiculous to think that anyone could have the capacity to do that. So that quest for omniscience seems to me a very bad pathology.
And I think it's also quite infantile. Mm-hmm. There's something developmental or kind of wanting to know everything. It almost reminds me of a kind of intrusive child kind of listening into adults' conversation.
Morbid curiosity of, yeah. well, there's something going on in there that I don't understand yet, you know.
But I want to point out something to you, and that is, I am not sure how congruent that is, that kind of, oh, privacy doesn't really matter to me.
With what? Congruent with what?
With actually what people were saying in your online safety bill episode of The Cyber Show, when asking kind of, is privacy important?
Yeah. Every single person said that it was. You're right. And so let's address that. The idea that people don't care about privacy comes principally from tech developers.
Yeah.
And from the technological political community.
Yeah.
That's what they want to think other people think.
Yeah.
And they push that viewpoint constantly. If you go to Slashdot or Hacker News or any of those West Coast American sites where they talk about constantly what they think other people want, and that's a really common kind of mansplaining patriarchal streak within that community. They've always got an opinion about what other people want.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they think other people want is that they don't care about privacy. And they say it over and over and over again. When you ask ordinary individual people on the street, do you think privacy is important? Universally, they say yes. So I think you're absolutely right. There is a clash of perceptions there.
I think that what it's really about is that people don't want to engage with the conflict that might come about through asserting their right for privacy. And it makes me think of a recent article where this person had put on a dating site conditions for what they would expect in a relationship. And one of the conditions that they put on the relationship is that they expected their partner to have their location device on their phone on all the time. Absolutely.
And that is like, that's the biggest kind of psycho siren.
Absolutely.
I can imagine.
And they had put something like, for reassurance and convenience.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So if that isn't an enormous red flag right there.
I am desperately needy and insecure. And I'd really like you to have one of those kind of Jabba the Hutt chains around your neck. Yeah, that's tragic. Okay, let's move on from that horror. What I saw in the interviews in the park, I got the feeling that there's a lot of dispirited people out there suffering from learned helplessness. Do you agree? And does the idea of learned helplessness around technology mean much to you?
What comes to mind with the expression learned helplessness is the idea that something will go terribly wrong if you, or that somehow someone will be punished if they do something that the perpetrator doesn't wish them to do. So people, for example, if someone is in a coercive controlling relationship and are told, no, I want to see your location all the time on my phone. I need to know where you are 24 hours a day. Actually, people do reach a point of just simply not arguing. They give up the fight because actually to do something radical like turn your location off on your phone or refuse to acquiesce to unreasonable demands actually is gonna be more problematic.
I'll just disambiguate my understanding of that a bit. What you're describing to me is resignation or defeat.
Yeah.
They've been beaten down.
Yeah.
And they've ceased to resist. Learned helplessness is a subtly different concept in that an oppressor has previously punished somebody for trying to be autonomous or to escape or whatever. But then after that oppressor has gone and the person is free, they still continue in those old patterns as if the oppressor still existed. So the oppressor no longer needs to be there, like an internalized superego policeman once the external coercion has gone.
What comes to my mind is the scene in Sleeping with the Enemy where Julia Roberts' character returns home and she's not sure whether the perpetrator is actually in her home or not. And she opens up her cupboard and she sees that the cans of food are arranged how the perpetrator always insisted that she arranged the cans. And she isn't sure whether she has done that to herself or whether he's broken into the home and is hiding somewhere, and almost as a sign.
That's a great example. That nails exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Learned helplessness is a self-defeating patterning that continues in the absence of the domination. So what I kind of got, I think, from a lot of the way people speak about technology is they've tried and they've failed and they've tried and they've failed and they've tried and they've failed and they just don't try anymore.
Yeah.
Obviously, people need successful stories, successful experiences of autonomy. I think that's something that we really need to look into. Last point on this one. Not only does the government literally not give a shit, I mean, and I'm framing that a little bit, meaning just judging by the amount of money that gets put into personal cybersecurity education. I mean, just to take it in terms of finances, they don't care. But it's conflicted because it actively wants to weaken security, to break the bonds of ownership and attachment in order, seemingly, to bolster its own waning power and legitimacy. And that's what we saw in the deception over the online safety bill. How do you relate to that, thinking a government's power is now challenged by big tech and it sees the autonomy of the population and freedom of communication, freedom of speech as a challenge to its power, which is awful because it's so regressive. All the things that we were just talking about, fearing secrecy, fearing that people are plotting, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, psychologically, what do you think of that?
Does make me think of how dehumanized and depersonalized authoritarian governments want their population to be.
They want a dead population, effectively dead. I mean, a zombie population of compliant, passive, docile, shuffling people who never have any thoughts, never have any ideas. It's a society that's bereft of art, literature, innovation. It's a dead society.
And who won't challenge them?
A government that would rather have a dead society than one that might challenge them. There's something necrotic about that. Who's the guy in Psycho who kind of pickles his mum and puts her in the chair so that he can have her forever?
Is it Bates?
Bates. It's a Bates motel, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the guy, right? He'd rather kill and stuff and have her in a glass cage than lose her.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of quite well describes that necrotic government that would rather have a dead population, but one that never challenges it.
Yeah.
The population's like a trophy wife or a pet. Yeah. It's a symbol of its success. How on earth do you challenge such deeply pathological institutional thinking?
I guess we're trying to do that now by setting up things like the Cyber Show, trying to advocate for digital self-defense. And in my field, in psychotherapy, there is something deeply political about psychotherapy because we are asking the people who come to see us and who pay for our services to think about their feelings and their behaviours and their reactions. So in a way, we are asking people to do the opposite of blind compliance. We are actually wanting people to question and reflect and be curious.
Well, if I was to put all those words together, I would say that you're asking them to live.
Yes.
People come to the consulting room in a sense partly dead. They have run into a dead end in life. And you ask them or invite them to talk about how they can live again. And I think the stuff that we're doing with the Cyber Show and various other people who are looking at this problem of the deadening effect of technology and authoritarianism. I mean, since like Eric Fromm, I mean, since Lewis Mumford, since those guys, right? And before, no doubt, asking people, how do you live? Do you dare to live again?
Yeah.
But I mean, and that's good. And we can empower people to retake their technology and so on.
Yeah.
And even in the face of AI, which I think may actually help. I think AI may expose the emptiness of much of that and cause an enormous, powerful backlash against deadening aspects of technology that are already far too down the road. You know, they'll bring it into sharp relief. But there's a separate question of how do you address that pathology of institutions and governments? How do you make them want to have a living population, to have great nations again, to have discoveries and innovations and the vitality of life that has existed before. Because it seems to me that our technocratic regimes, and through the technology and the alliances with big tech, kind of the forces of Thanatos, meaning the forces of death and forgetfulness, this sort of downward spiral into this static dead society. How on earth do you challenge that? You know, that's the really big question. What you hope, I guess, is that people who are essentially alive and humanist find their way more and more into positions of power and displace, replace. Niels Bohr, I think, said that science progresses one funeral at a time, meaning, you know, you just have to wait for all of those damaged people to grow old and fall out of the political process.
But I do see people being able to question that deadening. And it's really funny that you mentioned Thanatos and the forces of death and progress being one funeral at a time. I begin to see the green shoots of opposition to those forces of death. Like, after a long winter, there will be spring again. And I think that the green shoots exist in people like Patsy Stevenson, who had the courage of challenging the might of the Metropolitan Police. You know, and she is a modern day Antigone, because there is this individual young woman challenging the might of the state, who simply wanted to stop women collectively grieving and attending a vigil.
And she's a person of interest to us because she said that she was going to empower herself through code and hacking. I'm going to learn to hack. And so she's recognising technology as the battlefield, which is awesome. Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
I want to talk about social norms, and I'm thinking about how far too free and easy people are with their data. So I'm thinking about the moment where, in a family that I'm aware of, they were applying for a visa to go to Russia. This was before the invasion of Ukraine, etc. But the Russian visas require the passport details of all blood relatives. And this particular family kind of think, well, do we just take a photo of our passport and put it on WhatsApp so that for convenience of this person wanting to fill in a form about a visa? And actually, I'm thinking that that could have easily happened had it not been kind of a questioning of, hang on, is it really wise that in a WhatsApp chat there are...
Okay, well, evidently no.
Yeah.
You should never take high-resolution photographs of a passport.
Yeah.
It's a template to make a forgery for.
Yeah.
People don't realise that even in a fairly cheap smartphone, they have got a 10 or 20 megapixel camera.
Yeah.
The quality of that scan is enough to produce a forgery from. And simply taking that information and sharing it on a platform like WhatsApp, utter stupidity. You know, the problem comes when... because there is a massive disconnect of values and understandings about technology between quasi-authorities and little organisations that ask you to do things like that. Can you just take a scan of your birth certificate?
Yeah.
Can you just kind of write these details down and email them to me on this insecure channel with no encryption or whatever? Yeah, people, and most people just comply.
Yeah.
Increasingly, though, what we've got now is we've got a bigger group emerging of people who question that.
Mm.
And that's the intellectual self-defense element. That's the beginning. Mm. And the reason that they question it is because they've been trained to, say, through things like at work for phishing attacks.
Yeah.
Now, if your boss is going to write an email to you in all caps saying, urgent, reply immediately, the smart woman is the one who puts it in the trash, goes to her boss and says, I marked your email as a suspected phishing attack and I reported it to IT. Don't email me shouting in all caps again if that really was you, because that's unprofessional. That kind of very challenging behaviour comes from people who are conscientious, comes from people who are vigilant, comes from people who are smart and switched on to the situation and just say, no, I am not going to go along with that. No, I will not email you my details. No, I will not scan my passport. If you've got a problem with identity, with figuring out how I am, that's your problem. You figure out a way to satisfy your constraints on your side.
Yeah.
Figure out that if you satisfy yourself with who I am or whatever. Yeah. And if you can't, then just fuck off, because I am not going to do that for you.
Mm.
I'm not going to put myself at risk. I'm not going to, and generally, you're going to put other people at risk as well. The digital world and the civic cybersecurity exposes these deep, deep contradictions and conflicts of power. And what it comes down to is that there is no such thing as bare security. Your security is my insecurity, or my security becomes your insecurity. It's like a zero-sum thing.
Yeah,
you want to verify who I am by getting me to scan my passport, but that puts me at risk.
Yeah.
And you're unable to understand that and to provide the necessary secure channels for me to do that, et cetera, I will not engage in risky behavior just to satisfy you. And so that's emerging now, but it's only maybe about 10% of the population. And even less of people will actually follow through and convert that into action, but they will challenge verbally. What we want to do is we want to get that to kind of 40, 50% of the population, where people are technologically savvy, they've got ideas of civic cybersecurity and digital self-defense, and they won't be made insecure and made tools and forks of people, because you're just giving them convenience.
Yeah.
It's for their convenience, it's not for your convenience. Yeah. It's a long, slow process to change people's attitudes, but you have to make them skeptical and robust, firm, polite, reasonable, but no.
Yeah,
and it's that saying no. And I think what we wanted to explore really was that we want more women to be like that, because they seem to be the ones who are more often the victims, because they are overly compliant or...
kind of amenable.
Agreeable.
That touches on a whole realm of study and research about how gender difference in terms of socialisation, in terms of compliance and conformity.
Women are believed to be more agreeable,
yeah,
at least statistically. Do you think that comes out of socialisation?
I think it does. I don't think it's inevitable. I think it's socialisation.
So women should just say no more.
Absolutely.
And maybe if women say no to unreasonable shit more, that might encourage men to follow the examples of the women and say no as well.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk. That's all from Kate and Andy today. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode.